Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at the Agile 2016 conference in Atlanta, Georgia. Huge gathering, lots of people here, and been talking to lots of interesting people, and I've ran across Anders Wahlgren. He's the CTO of Electric Cloud. How are you doing, Anders?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So, for those who don't know, tell us the very brief Anders Wahlgren story.
Let's see. I've been in the industry for, I actually counted this, 27 years. I thought I had been at Electric Cloud for 11 years. It turns out it's actually 12. Mm-hmm. So time kind of flies when you're having fun, I think. But it's been a great ride just sort of watching all the changes that have happened in the industry. Mm. We're still not, I think, as good at doing this as we need to be. Mm-hmm. But I think we've sort of recognized we have a problem.
Yeah.
And so that's why we come to these sort of Agile support group meetings, like Agile and, all the other conferences that we go to.
Yeah, we all pat on the back and go, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. You're not crazy. It's not just you.
Mm. So what was your background before becoming a CTO?
Lots of different things. I mean, I started out as an engineer. I've worked on, network drivers, user interfaces, web applications, all those kinds of things, and basically spent the last 12 years working on our platform. That's the basis for the products that that we sell.
All right. So, Electric Cloud, your response here, but you give us a very quick, what is Electric Cloud?
We are DevOps release automation. So we allow our customers, usually operating at scale, larger customers, larger teams, large organizations, distributed organizations, really automate their software delivery pipeline from end to end, from laptop to live. And using whatever tools and scripts and things you're currently using in terms of, build tools or test tools or those kinds of things. But the idea being that single pane of glass, we're sort of the conveyor belt that moves your software through the pipeline to the point where it, gets deployed into production or gets burned into the firmware or, whatever the ultimate kind of goal or ultimate endpoint is for that software.
So the interesting thing you sort of said before, you've been there for 12 years and you're very much a DevOps company. That was way before DevOps was a thing.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but we named the company Electric Cloud in 2002, which was way before there was a cloud. Mm. Back then we just called them computers, but, really what we started out with was a build acceleration tool, essentially a parallel distributed make, and which gives you fantastic speed ups on your builds and those kinds of things. And as we started, working with customers to do that, customers started saying, but hey, there's more to this than the build, right? Can you help us run tests? Can you help us do deployments? And so that was our first product, Electric Accelerator, which is still a pretty big part of our portfolio. But then we brought out Electric Flow, which is kind of the follow-on to that, which is now let's automate the entire, kind of production cycle for your software, all the way through to production. And so really, in a sense, we've been pulled sort of, out of dev and into ops over the years. And we started out doing enterprise CI type problems, CI for 2,000 engineers at a time, and those kinds of things where open source tools don't necessarily have the ability to play. And then as we did that, then that's when Agile started taking over. And I think one of the reasons we were kind of successful in helping our customers do Agile is we really helped them bring down cycle times. And if you want to be Agile, you want a lot of feedback loops, and so it helps to kind of cut down on the cycle times. And so just over the course of many years, we've gotten involved in the Agile community and really gotten behind the Agile DevOps continuous delivery movements, which I think are different in some ways, but also have huge amounts of overlap in what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. So what's your state of the nation on continuous delivery and DevOps? Because it's been around for a while now.
Yeah.
I remember reading Release It by Michael Nygaard, which was I guess my first epiphany, and that was mid-2000s, late 2000s. But I still run to organizations who don't know what continuous integration is, which is
you're shocked. Yeah, yeah. No, we do too.
What is the state of the nation?
I think, I don't think we're ready to declare victory on Agile just yet, but it's certainly taken root and is now, it's the winning methodology, and whichever sub-methodology you pick under that, right? And I think what happened, and it's not a bad thing, it's just sort of is the way it worked out, is by and large, Agile ended up impacting mostly dev QA and obviously product ownership. And to a much lesser extent, release and ops. Now, that's a very arguable point of view, right? I mean, certainly the manifesto includes, the whole thing, deliver software to customers. Clearly that, includes the whole thing. But very practically speaking, where the tools vendors have played, where people have had problems, where the biggest pain points were, we focused very much on kind of the dev and QA problem for many, many years. And I think what's happening now is, you know, with CD in the mix and with DevOps in the mix, we're kind of plumbing that last mile to release and to deployment and into production. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other interesting thing that's kind of happening now is, and we're pushing pretty hard for this as a point of view in our products, is deployment really ought to now come a little bit more left. In the sense, and what I mean by that is, you shouldn't be doing your first deployment into production, right? When you're building this piece of software, you should have deployed it hundreds, if not thousands of times by the time you go into production, right? Your developers have to deploy, your QA people have to deploy. You've got lots of testing you're doing in your, you know, your pipeline stages. And it really makes a lot of sense to use essentially the same deployment process throughout that whole thing. And so that the way that you deploy your software becomes part of your software. It's a feature. And the way I kind of think about that a little bit is, if, you know, if we go back 15, 20 years, it was all desktop software. And we had to build installers for them. And installers are considered part of the product, right? Now, the way you deploy a web application, let's say, that is kind of the functional equivalent of the installer. And yet we don't really treat it as part of the product. You know, we think, you know, we just throw it over the fence and, you know, those.
I think that's because it's not client facing, because the thing with an installer was that it had to be a little bit usable because you wanted them to click options.
But it's an interesting thing, right? Because what did we do with installers typically? And this is not just my experience. I've sort of asked a lot of people about this. What we do with installers is nobody wants to work on them. So we give it to the least experienced member of the team. It's where they cut their teeth. But the thing is, installers are really freaking important. It's usually the customer's first exposure to the product, right, for an end user install. And they can be pretty tricky to do. You know, how do you do an install correctly so that you can do an uninstall? How do you do an installer correctly so you can do an upgrade? You know, how do you roll back an upgrade in the middle of the install when it fails and do that correctly? And guess what? Lots of the same kinds of problems that we deal with in doing deployments, right? And so, you know, if instead of saying installer, you say, you know, deployer, and if instead of saying customer, you say, you know, ops person, you know, it's an essential part of getting the software into the ultimate customer's hands. And yet we're kind of doing the same thing, right? We don't throw our best people at dealing with this stuff, right? Typically, again, it's going to be, you know, hey, there's the new guy. Give him the, you know, tell him to write all the Python scripts, and, you know, or write up all the deployment steps in the Excel spreadsheet or whatever. And I think we have to treat it the same way, because ultimately, you know, even though the customer of the deployment scripts or the deployment tools and processes is obviously ops, but ultimately it's the end user customer. And if we're not good at doing deployments, we're not delivering software to our customers. So, you know, and I think we're getting better at that. But in order to get really, really good at that, and sort of continuous delivery would sort of tell you this too, is, you know, you got to start your learning and developing of your deployment processes while you're developing the product. You know, it's really just that simple. So by the time you go into production, you're good at it, you've done it a lot, you know how to troubleshoot it, you know, ... So.
And one of the things, I mean, we just saw the keynote from Joshua Kriereski, and he was making the point, and he was, you know, highlighting organizations that are deploying, you know, every 12 seconds, all those type of things. We've all heard the stories, but what I'm hearing you saying, and it's what my experience is that's well and good if you're the Facebooks and the Etsys of the world.
The unicorns. Right?
The rest of the world is government organizations that perhaps have tricky things, or large corporates where they're just shipping things to internal users where that speed isn't, you know, is necessary there. But DevOps and continuous delivery is still an important part of that.
Absolutely. And I think one of the ways I think about that is, no matter who you are, you know, whether you're Etsy or a five-person startup or a, you know, General Electric or, you know, legacy software or any of that kind of stuff, the software process is kind of like human DNA. You know, we're all incredibly different from each other, and yet 99% of our DNA is the same, right? Software processes are the same, right? If at the end of your software delivery pipeline, you're going to burn it into firmware, or you're going to put it up on a website or what have you, that's a small difference compared to all the other stuff you got to do before then, right? And all the other stuff before then is the same. And you can make the argument, if you're making pacemaker firmware, right, you don't want to do deployments every 12 seconds. Probably not worth it. But if there's a major security flaw in that pacemaker software and somebody can, you know, FTP into my pacemaker and do things, you better have a software process where you can rapidly deliver a fix. And that's what, you know, that's what Agile, that's what CD, that's what DevOps, you know, kind of helps you do. So I think it's universally applicable. And we have many customers who are, you know, healthcare regulated, finance regulated, you know, Fortune 20 bank, aerospace, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, you know, and you know, they're doing air-gapped deployments into satellite base stations on coral atolls in the middle of the Pacific, right? It's interesting. But again, everything up until that point, it's the same as every other piece of software. So I think it's more universally applicable. And I think the really interesting thing now is you're starting to see, and I saw there was one session here, which fortunately was full, so I couldn't go to it, but it was basically, you know, how to do Agile in a DoD environment, right? And it's very interesting because, especially when companies are doing what they call cost-plus contracts, they have no incentive whatsoever to be more efficient in their processes. I think you have to push them into that by saying quality, more functionality, you know, kind of all of those things, because they kind of have a blank check to hire as many people as they want if that's going to solve their problems. But it's more universally applicable than just to the unicorns. And I think what we're going to see too is that the horses, as I like to call them, are going, you know, the large companies that have legacy software and want to be more agile, want to do DevOps, those kinds of things. There is going to be commercially available software, you know, not just from us, but from lots of other places where you can start to do this stuff. Where you know, if you're not Google and you don't have 10,000 people dedicated to working on that problem nonstop, you know, you can still, you know, get there and do that and do it, you know, safely, repeatably, at scale, and, you know, all the good things that that you want out of it.
So one of the things when you're often talking to people who are new to Agile, they sometimes, I can't imagine this world of continuous delivery, DevOps. What's your state of it? Is it are more and more organizations taking it? Is it crossing the chasm at this point?
I think we're getting pretty close. So you know, the one of the questions I always ask if I do a webinar, or survey, or talk, or something on Agile or any of those kind of things is, you know, where are you in that journey? You know, are you thinking about it? Are you starting? Are you there? Or, you know, and that started to shift to where, you know, 10 years ago, there would have been maybe, you know, 25% of the people were thinking about Agile and like 5% had done it. That shifted way to the right, you know, in terms of where the bars are in that graph. And that's encouraging, right? And I think a lot of people come now to not just learn at these kinds of conferences, but also to share. You know, here's how we did it. Here are the things that were kind of unique to us and how we got around them, you know. So if you have the same issue, then, you know, learn from us. And I think that's really important because, you know, yes, you have to go do the Scrum training or get into Kanban or do whatever you want. But I think you also have to have, sort of the craftsmanship, the apprenticeship, the knowledge sharing, the, you know, benefiting from other people's experience of how you do this in the real world. Because it is difficult to do it in the real world. You can't just follow the recipe. And largely because, you know, huge cultural changes are sometimes necessary to get this right. You know, process is important, tools are important. You know, I sell software for a living, so of course I'm going to say that. But you will fail if you don't pay attention to the cultural aspects of how you do Agile, CD, or DevOps. It's that simple.
And so the question is, you know, I mean, DevOps is kind of the cool term now, and we've been using the terms DevOps and CD, even CI to a certain extent, interchangeably, you know, automation, all that, all those kinds of things. Is DevOps more of the culture, do you think, and CD more of the engine room?
That's an interesting point of view. I think DevOps and Agile, I would say in terms of like who pays the most attention to culture, I'd probably put DevOps first and Agile second. CD, I think, is a little bit more about process, but also about cultural, right? Because, you know, one of the things you got to do with CD is, you know, build quality in. Don't check in code that's untested and cause build breakages and all that kind of stuff. And there's absolutely a cultural aspect to that. But clearly, I think, you know, DevOps, and if you go read the State of DevOps report, they pay huge amounts of attention to the cultural aspects of this stuff and tie it statistically to good outcomes. You know, it's difficult to do. Yeah, I mean, one of the things we're trying to do, no matter which of these, you know, frameworks or methodologies we're trying to use, is continuous improvement. I think that's a core aspect of any of these things. You can't do continuous improvement without a culture where people who bring up problems are not, you know, the messenger isn't shot, right? The messenger is, interrogated as to what happened, what's the problem, how do we remediate it now, but more importantly, what do we need to learn so that it doesn't happen again, right? If that was a bug that escaped into production, where should it have been caught? And why weren't we catching it? Do we need to add another, you know, was it a security problem and we're not doing enough security validation testing kind of stuff in our pipeline? Or and so those kind of, you know, generative organizations where you value learning over bureaucracy and punishment and those kinds of things tend to be the most successful, no matter, you know, no matter what label they attach to sort of what they are, you know, and I think that really is very important. And then my second thing I would say is really important is automate everything, you know, and that I say selfishly because that's the business we're in. But it's also true that so many errors are introduced by manual processes. So many delays are introduced by manual processes. So much valuable data is lost because it scrolls by on the screen when the person types the thing in and hits return. And you know, collect all that data, make it reliable, repeatable, shareable, scalable, secure, you know, blah, 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 all those kinds of things. And that is a core technical aspect to get a good at any of these things. But culture is, you know, that's the thing companies ought to worry about the most. Because that is, you know, we've really, in some sense, set ourselves up for failure the way most teams have been organized historically. And that's changing a bit, which is really nice. So
one of the things I see when teams start to go down the CD path is, you know, they've already got their tool, their you know, their Jira or their you know, their version one or whatever tool they might be using, and they've got their CI tool, so they might be using something like a Jenkins or something, which is a great tool, and they start trying to build pipelines and things in there, and they get themselves a little bit messed up. Why would they come and use your tool over something they can build themselves for free out of a bunch of bash scripts and sort of software?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of things come down to, you know, what are your pain points? You know, so we deal with organizations that end up with, you know, 50, 75 different Jenkins servers and 50 and 75 different Jenkins administrators. And the anecdote I kind of tell around that is, you know, when I started in this industry, my company had two email servers, right? There was a Solaris box running Unix mail, or, you know, Solaris mail for the engineers to use, and there was a Quickmail running on a Mac in marketing. And eventually we figured out how to get those two things to talk to each other so that we could communicate, because, you know, engineers don't do that face-to-face. But each department ran its own email server, right? We don't do that anymore. I mean, in fact, we probably don't even have email servers on-premise anymore, right? There's no reason, and we don't go build our own compilers. We don't go build our own IDEs. We don't, you know, there's no reason why you should go build this thing over and over and over and over and over and not in a kind of a scalable way. Now, wonderful tool and you know, obviously out there and huge, and you know, so many of our customers obviously use things like, you know, Jenkins and Hudson and all these other things. And then, you know, when that artifact gets created, that's kind of where we pick off and then run it through the rest of the pipeline, manage the release, do the deployments, you know, all of those kinds of things. And so really what our customers are looking for is, you know, in some cases, scalability, right? They're running, you know, industrial sized, you know, kinds of things, you know, millions of pipelines a month, tens of thousands of pipelines a month, you know, 10,000 releases a year, you know, those kinds of things, 45,000 engineers. So trying to do that at scale is difficult. And then also kind of with the advent of, you know, what Gartner is calling bimodal IT, which I you know, they're sort of breaking it down into the old way and the new way. And I think actually it should probably be called multimodal IT, because really there's going to be a huge spectrum. And what tends to happen with a lot of the products that are out there is they're only going to support their way of doing things, very prescriptive kind of ways of doing things. And we've always been known for our flexibility. You, whatever your process is and you want to do in the system, you can do. You know, if it's screwed up today, you could still, you know, build it in our system as screwed up as it is, but you can start there and then start to try to improve it, right? We're very cognizant of, you know, we don't want to ask our customers to change the tires on the car while we're driving down the freeway, right? It's very difficult to do that. But you have to kind of migrate and get, you know, kind of get somewhere. So when you need flexibility, when you need security, when you need scalability, those kinds of things, that's when we come in and, you know, help solve those kinds of problems. So
okay. What's new coming down the line? I mean, this is a environment that's changing rapidly.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're obviously evolving to customer needs.
Yeah.
What sort of things can we look for in DevOps in general, and then how is the product responding to that?
So I think what's starting to happen now in kind of in DevOps automation or you know, kind of I guess you wouldn't really say agile automation because that doesn't make any sense. But, you know, kind of DevOps automation is we're starting to see more more things like financial institutions really hopping on board. So we've got some major, major financial customers. I can't use any of their names, mm-hmm. but, you know, Fortune 20 bank and huge trading company and huge online mortgage company. And, you know, you've heard of all these names. They are now starting to realize that in the case of the Fortune 20 bank, they have 6,000 applications. Some of them are internal, but a lot of them are not. They have 140-something thousand endpoints in their data centers. And it's a giant, you know, kind of problem for them to solve that requires huge amounts of effort and starts to burn people out. And, they have a 2-hour window occasionally to do a deployment, you know, into production. So performance of deployments when you're going to push out to these kinds of scale systems is a big deal. So I think it's starting now to take root in companies that before would have said, oh my God, we're going to have to go build that ourselves. Mm-hmm. And they're now starting to look, you know, evaluate and actually choose commercial solutions mm-hmm. As opposed to having to go off and build it themselves, which, you know, even just 5 years ago, they would have gone off and done that. Mm-hmm. And financial institutions have always been kind of, you know, we will throw money at the problem technologically because we realize that's a differentiator, right? So they're hopping on board. But also healthcare institutions and other regulated things like aerospace and so on are really realizing that we want to be agile. You know, we want to do DevOps. We want to, you know, we want to deliver better software faster, you know, whatever label you want to put around it. And so they're actually starting to realize, look, the way we're doing things, we can do it better. Hmm. And yes, we have special requirements, auditability, governance, you know, security, all of those kinds of things, but we can fit that in there. Hmm. You know, we can make that work. And, you know, especially when the DevOps movement started, it freaked a lot of people out because, you know, the first thing you think is, oh my God, my developers are going to be in my data center, mm-hmm. right? How am I going to, you know, and the auditors are like, no, you know, separation of duties and Sarbanes-Oxley. And actually, it's kind of turned out to be the opposite, which is in order to do DevOps really well, you have to automate. Mm-hmm. And an auditor really wants two things out of you, right? Document what you do, prove that you did what you documented. Mm-hmm. Well, if you've automated something, that's kind of documentation, yeah. right? You may need to, you know, massage it a little bit into the format that's necessary, and then you execute that automation. Well, there's your proof that you did it the way, and now you've got an audit trail of who did it, when, why, was it successful, what change lists were involved, you know, all of the things that they want, you get almost for free. So DevOps has actually kind of been the auditor's friend now. Mm. James DeLuca, James DeLuca wrote a really good book on this in terms of, you know, look, auditing and DevOps are not enemies. You know, yeah. we're actually friends. And do a few things, and you'll be very happy with that relationship. And that's a pretty cool thing to see mm-hmm. too, actually.
And so, what sort of things are you looking into the future to build into your tool to then, you know, continue the DevOps journey that we're on?
So the next thing that we're working on and are releasing imminently is basically it's rolling deployments for the masses, mm-hmm. for the non-unicorns, or deploy like a unicorn is our little tagline. And it's basically, you know, what our customers and especially our large customers came back to us and said, look, we want to do this with zero downtime, right? We want to avoid downtime as much as possible during our deployments. And, you know, we can't really do blue-green deployments because we have such a massive production environment, we can't afford to have two of them. Mm. So we want to do rolling deployments and phase them out. So we've built functionality where you can literally either, you know, click and point in the UI or use our domain-specific language to, on an environment-by-environment basis, specify how you would do a rolling deployment in there. You know, do you want to... You know, let's deploy to these 5 machines in this tier, then we run this test. If that's successful, then we deploy to the rest of them. Or deploy to, you know, 28% of the machines in this tier, then do, you know, so you can drag and drop out your phased deployment that way. And that's environment specific. And again, kind of going back to our point of view, which is you should be building your deployment processes as you build the product. In the product, you can model your app and model your environments, and then you can kind of pour your application into these various environments. And if you're deploying into a dev or QA environment, you probably don't need a phased deployment. So it goes, you know, much more straightforward, much faster. if it's a dev deployment, you probably don't even have firewalls and load balancers that need to get configured and those things. That kind of happens a little bit later. But, you know, you're sort of using the same process, you know, kind of throughout. Mm-hmm. And then we've also added on top of that the ability to do release calendaring and environment reservations and blackouts and those kinds of things, so that our customers that operate at these kinds of scales can manage all of these things in kind of one system, one pane of glass. So that's what we've been working on lately.
Excellent. Sounds great. Well, people want to know more about Electric Cloud, more about the kind of stuff that you guys do, where can they find out more information?
A couple of ways. Always, come to our website. We also do a every 2 weeks podcast called C9D9, mm-hmm. Which is continuous discussions. And it's just a general purpose kind of, we pick a topic, we get 3 or 4, 5 panelists on from the industry, and we just have kind of a roundtable discussion on a particular issue. And it's mm-hmm. very, no prep required, kind of, it's a very low key kind of thing. But we very often have great discussions. Mm-hmm. And we've done, I think we're getting up to close to 50 of them now. So mm-hmm. that's another great way to do that. We also have what we call our release automation wiki, which is also a pretty cool place to go. And it's a very, we keep it very vendor neutral and those kinds of things, and just go through a lot of the, hey, here's good resources for learning about this, here's some pointers, here's what we think, those kinds of things. Very, pretty non-commercial, I would say, for that kind of thing. So there's lots of resources out there to learn not just about us, but yep. but about the whole thing in general. Mm-hmm.
And to find out more about the product and what you guys do,
go to the website. Mm-hmm. You can download the product and play around with it. You can read our white papers. Mm-hmm. You can talk to us. Mm-hmm. Whatever you need to do.
And the website is
www.electric-cloud.com.
Excellent. And people want to know more about you.
I'm Anders_Wahlgren on Twitter. Feel free to tweet me, and we can have conversations.
Excellent. So there's one thing we always do at the end of the podcast. We're here at the Agile conference, and we like to say Viva La Revolution. That's our tagline. So would you join in with me?
Viva La Revolution.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.